Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call's One Planet series. The new documentary, Wild Days, is a powerful cinematic call to action. It explores how the ongoing conflict between humans and wildlife in Africa has resulted in the rapid decline of the elephant population and many other species. Through interviews with experts from Jane Goodall to wildlife hunters, today's guest, filmmaker Phyllis Stewart, looks at the relationship between animal poaching, the illegal ivory trade, and human beings, and examines how rampant corruption complicates the fight to save species from extinction. In Africa, 40,000 elephants are killed every year. The global elephant population is just 400,000, which means one day the planet might be without one of its most magnificent species. So what is being done to protect and save animals that are on the verge of extinction? Today, we're joined by Phyllis Stewart, a filmmaker and the director of Wild Days, and she joins us from the studios of NPR in Culver City. Hi, Phyllis. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. We're also
And us, I should say.
Yes, and you. Right. Andrea Crosta is executive director.
Andrea.
Correct.
Thank you.
Yeah, Andrea Crosta. Thank you.
Thank you. Andrea Crosta is executive director and co-founder of the Elephant Action League, a nonprofit whose mission is to end wildlife crime through various projects in the field and online campaigns. Hi, Andrea. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Nice to have you. Okay, so I wanted to let people know also that Wild Days will have its world premiere at this year's Mill Valley Film Festival if you're in Northern California, and you can find more information at yourcallradio.org. Phyllis, let's start off with you. First of all, thank you for making this film really beautiful, but also very heart-wrenching.
And I did you watch it?
Of course.
Did you see it, Rose?
I did, yes. Oh, no, it was
a lot of people are afraid to watch it. I don't know why. It's not that scary.
Well, I think, you know, people are, there's a lot going on right now, and there's a lot of people are, you know, there's a lot of depressing things in the film, but it's so important to see. So I understand that this actually began as an investigation into elephant poaching.
Yes, and that's one of the reasons that one of my early interviews was with Andrea, because he started the Elephant Action League, and I didn't know anything about elephants. I didn't know anything about Africa 5 years ago. I was kept getting these pictures, like all of us do, 4 or 5 years ago, with all the elephants missing their faces, and I just couldn't believe that this was happening. I'm so sheltered, even though I'm, you know, an educated person. I don't know, didn't know anything. So I got to the bottom of it by interviewing over 100 people and traveling to 9-10 countries, and I know way too much now.
Well, and there's so much to explore, but give me just one maybe myth that you thought about before you went into this, because it's...
Yes. Oh, that's a great question. Thanks, Rose, because Americans want to go in with the army, right? We want to go in and just stop the poachers and shoot them and jail them. And, you know, we've got the very Puritan ethic and a very worldview, that Puritan worldview. And it is not about the poachers. I talked to an Israeli guy who'd been on the ground for 10 years in Africa, and he said, Phyllis, you can shoot poachers all day long. It is not them that are doing it. If they're, like Andrea says in that movie, if you're going to get 5 years salary to shoot an elephant, they do it here in Los Angeles. They do it anywhere. It's just, there's just so much money, and it's really, international cartels are fueling this. The same guys running guns, the same guys running women, drugs. They're the guys doing the illegal wildlife crime, and it's almost $20 billion a year.
Wow.
So everybody's got their hand in the cookie jar. And it's not just that we're losing the wildlife. The wildlife, you know, provides something called an ecosystem service. They provide seeds in the dung, and I didn't know that 90 species of trees in the forest are propagated from the seeds of elephants. And forest elephants have been decimated. And we need the Congo Basin. That water travels all the way around to California. It actually waters the wine in Northern California.
That was
amazing.
Thank
you, elephants.
Amazing to learn about that. Andrea, you're executive director of the Elephant Action League. How did you get involved with this kind of work?
It's an interesting question, because I have, a parallel professional career in conservation and also intelligence, security, anti-piracy, and things like that. So about 5-6 years ago, I was in in Kenya working on a security assignment for a politician. So that back then, my main job was consulting on high level, security matters. And I saw with my eyes what was happening to elephants, and I saw what was missing. So the huge knowledge gap that we had back then, and we still have now, in terms of, we know quite a bit about poachers. We know quite a bit about, what's happening in China, for example, with the consumers, but we know very little what happened in between. So I decided to merge those two sort of professional careers, conservation and security intelligence, creating Elephant Action League, which is one of the few organizations in the world that put basically intelligence collection and investigations at the center of our strategy to fight back. And it's very, very important for any kind of wildlife crime, illegal supply chain, in this case ivory, to look at the entire supply chain, not just, ground zero where poachers operate, and not just at the very end where, the consumers. Actually, the real enablers, the real drivers are in the middle. In the middle of the supply chain. So we decided to do just that. So we collect intelligence, we investigate high-profile international traffickers, illegal traders, corrupt government officials, in order to try to find the best way to disrupt this horrible chain.
So tell us more about this chain, because there is a lot of either misinformation or people just don't know how this operation works.
Well, I just, before Andrea jumps in, I just found out that there's three ports basically where the elephant ivory are getting out of, and the government has to be in on it. So Kenya has Mombasa port, and there's Zanzibar, and there's Dar es Salaam in Tanzania. So those two countries are culpable. Those two countries' leaders, if they wanted to stop this, they would be arresting people at the ports, but they don't. They just had, who was it, Faisal, the big kingpin? He was sentenced in Kenya to 20 years. He's the big, big known ivory poacher on the continent, and he was let off.
Yeah, this supply chains, the supply chain of ivory begins, at what I call ground zero for poaching. So Eastern Africa, Central Africa, where the poachers kill elephants very often for just, a few bucks. They are poor people, very often exploited as much as the animals, and used by traffickers. Just give you an example. We are very active in Southern Africa, not only on elephants but also on rhinos. So we managed to get very close to a few very, very important heads of poaching and trafficking syndicates in Southern Africa. Some of them are Mozambican, some others are South African, and by with our undercover team spending time with them, engaging them, we understood how little they care whenever someone killed 10 or 100 poachers. For them, is a non-issue. And this is the beginning of the supply chain. Then ivory changes hands quite quickly. It is usually assembled in a big shipment, maybe a container. As Phyllis said, there are a few exit points for ivory from Africa. Mombasa is important in Kenya, Tanzania. There is Mozambique. There is Libreville on the west coast of Africa. And then from there, the ivory starts its long journey to the destination, which is China. But very often, ivory doesn't get to China directly anymore, because Chinese authorities are getting a little bit more assertive and pay more attention. So here we have the incredibly important role of so-called transit countries, and they are very important not just for ivory but for any kind of illegal wildlife product right now. So transit countries, especially Southeast Asia, I'm talking about Laos, Vietnam, Cambodia, Thailand, including Singapore, Malaysia. So most of these illegal commodities now go through there. And it's actually in those countries that now the majority of serious wildlife traffickers operate. Mm. They have been operating for many, many years. They're very comfortable. Again, there is very little intelligence work, so they're comfortable. And they've been making millions of dollars out of ivory, out of rhino. And then from there, they smuggle the ivory into China. And then when it gets into China, it's a sort of a big black hole. It's, as you probably know, fortunately, China banned the legal market since beginning January 18. probably this is the most important thing ever happened to elephants. So this year is a very important year to see if after this decision we'll have less seizures and less animals killed in Africa.
Phyllis, I was shocked to learn, based on one of the interviews that you did, that 70% of people in China do not know that ivory comes from elephant tusks.
Well, you know why? Because elephants, and I didn't know anything about elephants, just like most people, that they have molars, and the molars actually, over the course of their life, fall out. The molars fall out 6 times, and in the end, an old elephant will actually starve to death because they don't have any molars. But the tusks, the incisors, those do not fall out. So I'm told by Grace Gabrielle over at IFWA that's exactly why the Chinese needed to be educated. But there's the Chinese consumers aren't really the ones that, and I know that WildAid went after them and they targeted them and collaborated with China. But it's really, in my experience, it's a multi-pronged approach, but it's really the cartels. These guys operate with impunity in Laos, as Andrea says. It's like a lawless state, the Golden Triangle. Look it up. It's the Chinese come over and it's a party, and they can do whatever they want. They can buy whatever they want, and it just breaks your heart. And it's not just about the wildlife. I want people who want to see this movie to understand that this is not an African problem. This affects everyone. And in many, many ways, we need oxygen. We need the rainforest, and we need the primates that are being taken out of there for the pet trade and for bushmeat. We need the elephants. We need these seed dispersers in our environment to keep it healthy.
Mm. Talking more about the corruption and the greed, you interviewed someone who said that that's the cause of the crime. Illegal wildlife trade is not rooted in poverty. Poverty has nothing to do with this. I was surprised by that. Can you elaborate more on that?
I know, that's Ofer Drury. You know Ofer, right, Andrea?
Yeah, but I don't agree with this statement. I think
really?
Exploitation of poverty, I think, in those areas is... It's a lot of similarities also with the narco trafficking and other kind of trafficking. You know, when in those areas where so many people are poor, and you can pretty much buy them with a few dollars, as a trader, as a trafficker, as a criminal, you can achieve a lot.
Or you can enslave them. You can forcibly enslave them, like they do in the Eastern Congo. Where, you know, they come in and they illegally mine and they kidnap children, and it happens in the Western DR Congo. It happens. It's really rampant. I mean, Americans are very, very lucky that we have infrastructure and a safety net with our government, but there are many lawless parts of Africa, and the criminals are just having a field day at the expense of millions and millions of people. I mean, 6 million people have been murdered for our cell phones. And the elephants are the way that these guys, you know, buy their guns and boots and bullets.
Andrea, can you talk more about that? I mean, if you're living in a country with a corrupt government and a failed state, and this is an opportunity to feed your family, most of us would do it, right? So can you talk more about that? Because I was really surprised by this statement.
Yeah, absolutely. No, of course, I would do it, honestly, and I say it all the time. I mean, I put yourself in the shoes of someone who has a family of 10 waiting at home, because of course there is no family planning, nothing over there. So, a family of 10, very poor, and I get I'm a trafficker, and I get I meet you, and I offer you 2, 3, 4 years of salary to kill a couple of elephants. Of course you do it, and I would do it, and anyone would do it to save their family. So that's why it is very, very important to fight, to tackle the supply chain along the entire supply chain, not just in Africa, because every time you operate only in Africa, for example, with anti-poaching. Anti-poaching is very important. You keep animals alive, but you don't address the problem. You are in an area with millions of really poor people, very often surrounded by heavily corrupted government officials. And so what do you want me to do? I mean, I just mind my business. And if someone asks me to kill an elephant and I know how to do it, that I'll do it, and that's exactly what on what the traffickers are thriving off. You know, it's the exploitation of millions of poor people. They're ready to do anything.
Mm. Phyllis, you also spoke with people who said that so much of what we're dealing with right now is directly connected to the legacy of colonialism in Africa. Can you also talk about that?
Well, I think it's a very good question. I think most of where the problems are focused right now have been in Central Africa and Eastern Africa, and they were colonialized by, you know, the British on the whole and the Germans and the Belgians. But in Mali, for instance, there's this group called WILD with Vance Martin, and what they did was they went in to Mali to fight to save the desert elephants, and there's not very many of them, but they worked for 2 years to talk to the people, because the approach is not working to go in and tell them what to do. Come on, people, here's what we're going to do. No, nobody wants to be dominated. They want to be included in the conversation. They want to be, you know, educated, but they also want to be consulted and part of the solution. Africans are not children, you know. We don't need to infantilize them. We need to include them. So one of the things that they did was talk to the people in Mali about how to get the jihadists who were coming down, the ISIS was coming down into Mali, and they wanted to kill their elephants and take their camels. And they sat down with these jihadists and said, look, guys, we need our camels, and here's why. We want the elephants here. It's one of the few interviews I felt like these people in Mali, certainly there are some poaching incidents of the desert elephants, but they wanted the elephants. There's this word called baraka, which is a beautiful word in many religions about how the unity and the health of all helps everyone. Like one part helps everyone to be well. And they embrace this in this part of northern Africa. So it's really like a country by country basis. But there is a pushback to colonialism. There is a pushback when you say, hey, how about some family planning? You know, like Andrea was saying, I talked to a Congolese man that we want to do a project with to bring some conservation agricultural project into Western Congo. And I said, could we offer the women who have on average 16 children, could we offer them some birth control? And he sort of laughed, and he grew up in this area, and he's worked there for 10 years with Wildlife Works to bring some stability to this area. And he said, look, they have 16 children there because the malaria is so bad, they don't know how many kids are going to survive. And the malaria nets that they were given are used to fish out the lake. They're not used to prevent malaria. And there's also, for instance, you know, there's witchcraft that's still practiced. And so they won't go to the health clinic. They go to the witch doctor to cure their child of malaria. You know, the president of the DR Congo hasn't supported this area for 3 decades. So nobody's gone to school. It didn't used to be like that. But, you know, again, it's the corruption of the government leaders not protecting the people and self-enriching. And, you know, this film taught me the term kleptocracy, which is sort of what we're witnessing here in America. Like, our leaders are personally enriching themselves and not taking care of everyone.
Well, Andrea, what would you add? Because in addition to colonialism, you have a lot of Western conservationists going to different countries in Africa and basically saying, you know, this is what you need to do. We need a park here. And then you have corporations coming in and saying, we want to lodge here. We're going to build a road here and push you out. And the man at the end of the film, his name is escaping me, but he's from, is it Survivors International?
Yeah.
Phyllis?
Yeah. We were talking about the Baka in Cameroon being forced out by
right.
the World Wildlife Fund.
And he basically said that it's not up to the people in the West to tell, you know, people here how to live. So, Andrea, what would you say about that?
Stephen Corey, thank you.
Well, it's a very difficult question because in principle, I agree with those people saying this is our life, this is our country, our continent. We have to decide how to live and how to manage our natural resources. In principle, I agree. But then in practice, it doesn't happen. In practice, we have to be honest, and they need the support from the West in order to take better care of their natural resources, including the animals and the national parks. Yes, many NGOs, especially big NGOs, arrive in Africa with not only with a big ego and a big wallet, but also, you know, because of that, they think they can dictate. And they some, very often they're successful in dictating to these people how to do it and what to do it, and you know, and it's, and you get into a very difficult situation because there's a lot of money on the table, and for local, I give you an example without making, you know, making any names, but if a big NGO arrives in a country like, I don't know, Kenya or Tanzania, and offers millions of dollars to do, to, you know, to run a conservation project, protect the park, protect the elephants, it's very difficult to say no. Hmm. Especially because they don't have money usually to do conservation. They have very little money. But by saying yes, then they sort of become, you know, the leverage of these big NGOs is huge. It's a sort of catch-22 situation. I think African nations need Western support to do a better job. On the other hand, there is probably a better way to do it. But one important thing that is has a big impact on my work personally is that whenever big NGOs or any kind of NGOs start working with the government in Africa, there is one thing they don't do, which is intelligence collection and investigation, because it's very dangerous, because it pisses off governments, because you cannot publish a harsh report if you are in the country with the office and staff. They will kick you out the day after. So that's part, which is, in my opinion, huge. Is actually performed by very few organizations, like our organization. On purpose, we don't have offices in those countries, because, you know, independence and integrity is everything. Many other NGOs are in the business of, you know, running big national parks and launching large anti-poaching campaigns and do capacity buildings and training. All important things, if done properly. But they tend to sort of become the new colonialist of Africa, so to speak, right? Because if I'm so big, and my, you know, there are NGOs, sorry, there are environmental NGOs that have, you know, $100 million budget. So you can imagine, they're like companies. When they arrive in a country, I mean, very difficult to say no.
It's so great because one of the women in my film, Gretchen Peters, she worked a lot in the poppy trade, you know, in Afghanistan. And she said, what you have to get your head around is America used to be able to exercise influence in Africa with its aid, the aid packages, or dangling the aid or withholding the aid if they didn't participate and properly behave. But now the illegal wildlife trade is 10 times what they get in aid. So it's very hard to exercise influence and get them to do something that's more appropriate. But what the promise of my film and the promise of my intention of making this film is that we can actually help Africans develop their land differently than what we did in America. Look what we did. We killed 30 million buffalo, and we decimated the people living here, and we put farms up, and a lot of people from Europe and other places came here. But the colonialists didn't do this so much in Africa. They didn't wipe out the Africans. They did a fence and shoot conservation policy, like our, you know, who was it? Wasn't Wilson that created our parks? Teddy Roosevelt. Right, that whole fence and shoot for hunters. That isn't working so well in Africa. There's too many people. So the people who live near nature and live with wildlife essentially have to have a benefit or they won't protect it. So many ways you can create projects that help them where they can actually see a benefit. The money actually has to go to the people, not the concessionaire who has a, you know, a photographic safari outfit or a hunting safari outfit. The people have to benefit, or they'll just poach, or they'll just perpetuate the bushmeat, you know, and kill everything in the forest. You know, Nick Russ Mittermeier, who's one of the heroes of conservation, said there are forests in Western Africa, the nice forest, but empty.
Right. Today we're joined by Phyllis Stewart, filmmaker and director of the new documentary Wild Days, which looks at what's being done to save animals like chimps, lions, and elephants from extinction. It examines the challenges facing animals and local communities living in Africa. We're also joined by Andrea Crosta, executive director and co-founder of the Elephant Action League, a nonprofit whose mission is to end wildlife crime. And if you're in Northern California, in the Bay Area, you can see Wild Days. It'll have its world premiere at this year's Mill Valley Film Festival, and you can find more information at yourcallradio.org. This is Your Call's One Planet series, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Call's One Planet series. I'm Rose Aguilar. Tomorrow, we will talk about the Federalist Society and the Judicial Crisis Network. Each group is spending millions of dollars to ensure that Brett Kavanaugh becomes a Supreme Court justice. They are airing ads on the cable shows. And then on Wednesday, we will talk about the FBI investigation. There are lots of moving parts to that. A number of people say that they want to speak, but they haven't been able to contact the FBI. So we'll talk about the latest. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, yourcall@kalw.org. And if you'd like to join today's conversation, if you have any questions, the issue of species extinction in Africa has many, many layers to it. There's a lot of corruption. There's a lot of crime. Colonialism definitely needs to be talked about. Western groups that go into Africa and say that they know what works best needs to be talked about. So if you work on these issues or if you'd like to comment, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Phyllis Stewart is director of the new documentary Wild Days, which is premiering at this year's Mill Valley Film Festival. Find more information at yourcallradio.org. Phyllis, we also air on other stations in other states. How can other people see the film?
Well, that's a great question. There's a couple of distributors who've approached me about distributing the film, and I'm not quite sure how we're going to do that. This is my fourth documentary, and I really am a little nervous about how to best do it because I wanted as many people to see this as possible. So one of the approaches that has changed in documentary filmmaker distribution, and it's called an impact campaign. And what you do is you raise $100,000 and you take your movie into cities and you get groups that are associated or affiliated with this cause to attend your movie, and you get journalists to write about it, and you build buzz and awareness for the cause that way. Another way you do it is you just get a sales agent and you sell it to a Hulu or Netflix or CNN, and you get it out there and, you know, hope they do a great job in getting your movie out there. It's, you know, it's tricky. There's a lot of films about wildlife in Africa, but what I made a film about was how it impacts all of us. And it's not a movie about Africa. It's a movie about human beings, because what there is this experience I learned called speciesism, which is this kind of arrogance that human beings have about how we believe that we're the top of the food chain. And it's sort of like sexism or, you know, like that. It's like we put ourselves above another species. And in fact, what Jane Goodall, she's an ethologist, and they talk about how we are not the only beings, if we can actually wake up to the fact that we're all beings, maybe we can evolve as a species, because saving these animals is actually about saving ourselves.
Yeah, there's actually a great documentary called Speciesism about that exact topic and that exact issue. That is Phyllis Stewart, director of Wild Days, and Andrea Crosta is executive director and co-founder of the Elephant Action League, a nonprofit whose mission is to end wildlife crime. And let's hear from Alexandra in San Francisco, who's the co-founder of the group Wild Safe. Hi, Alexandra. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call. I wanted to ask Phyllis about this impact campaign. Actually, Phyllis is the co-founder with me with Wild Safe which is the Impact Campaign. And I wanted Phyllis to address to the audience the importance of consumers learning about the ingredients that they are eating in food products and how that can protect wildlife.
All right. Thank
Hi,
you,
Alexandra.
Alexandra.
Thanks for calling. I called Alexandra about six weeks ago when I found out I was going to be debuting the movie, because the film festival in Mill Valley put the film and programmed it into a part called Active Cinema. And one of the things they invite the filmmakers to do in that programming section is to create an impact campaign. So there's a lot of films, I mean, a lot of projects I could have focused on. There's a lot of prongs. There's a lot of approaches. And they're all on my website if you want to go look under Impact Campaign. But one of the things I found is that, like Andrea was saying, is that the people are super poor. Like in Western Congo, I think the average weekly salary or daily salary is like 34 cents for a family of five. I mean, it's so low that these people have to survive somehow. So what if the cacao were harvested and grown in a way that the rainforest didn't get decimated, and that people can actually vote with their dollars? You know, they can buy products that don't destroy our environment, that don't enslave children, that don't impoverish people. Like the average, I've figured out the cacao farmers make something like $500 a year.
Wow.
And the chocolate industry has decimated the forests in Cote d'Ivoire. Mm. Did I say that correctly? Cote d'Ivoire? In Western Africa. And you don't have to break down the forest. In fact, cacao grows in shade with tall trees. And so we all came together and said, let's transform or upgrade the cocoa industry. That's one of my campaigns for the impact for the film.
And where can people find information about that? Because obviously the chocolate industry is just massive everywhere. The $500 yearly salary, is that chocolate that people in the West buy?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's interesting because in Eastern Congo, Ben Affleck created the Eastern Congo Initiative, right? And he went to Theo Chocolate, and those guys work in the eastern part of the Congo, and 70% of his cocoa comes from the Eastern DRC, which is very, very tumultuous and very impoverished because of all the political unrest and the coltan mining and all the things and all the things that go on there. So I put something on my website called Wild Safe. So it's pretty organized around the groups that we're going to save, the bonobos we're going to save, live in this part of the world, and the chimps in the DR Congo, and in Borneo and Sumatra, the poor little baby elephants and orangutan are being decimated by the palm oil. So I went to, I'm sorry I'm rambling, but the woman on the phone, Alexandra, has a product called Nubia, which is already protecting wild orangutans who are basically, you know, murdered as agricultural pests. So we created this impact campaign. It's a conservation agricultural product. And what we want to do is make sure that all our farmers engage and learn about how to protect the environment and sustainably grow cacao. And they're also well paid. And their children aren't, you know, sold from one country and taken to Western Africa to farm and work as indentured servants or slaves. Hmm. So that's what WildSafe is about.
Well, thank you so much, Alexandra. Thanks for your work. And we will put a chocolate show on our list. We should definitely do that soon.
Oh, her chocolate's amazing.
Well, and then we did a show about orangutans last year. You can find it at yourcallradio.org and what they're facing. Thank you for calling. Let's go next to Virginia. Hi, Virginia. Welcome to the show.
Hi, how are you? Hi, Phyllis.
Oh, it's Virginia Morell. Oh, yes. My gosh, you guys, you don't know who this is. Did she tell you who she was?
Yes, I said that I wrote the book Animal Wise, How We Know Animals Think and Feel, and that I've been, you know, a contributor to National Geographic, and I was interviewed by you for this film, and I'm just so excited that it's finally coming out, that it's being premiered in Mill Valley next week. It's next week, right?
It starts on October 8th, and then we have a one on the 10th and the 13th. What's so great about Virginia is she's an amazing journalist, and she writes about science, and she interviews really smart people, and so she asks really smart questions, and she was so great in the movie because she helped me transition from topic to topic to topic, because she has a wide range of understanding of many, many problems, including cacao, including poaching, including everything. And I was so inspired to talk to her because Animal Wise is a book about animals having a sentience, having more than they don't just fulfill a need for human beings. You know, they
have lives.
They deserve to be. Yeah, they deserve to be protected for themselves.
Mm. Yeah, and I think that's one of the things that the film gets across too, is the fact that elephants and bonobos and the other animals in the forest, even birds, they're all living meaningful lives and having experiences the way that we do, and they have emotions like we do because of our shared evolutionary past. Scientists now know this, and so when we think about trying to save an animal like the elephant, it's almost as if we're saving, part of our kin, our kinship that has evolved on planet Earth. And so, we're often struck by the idea of going elsewhere in the universe to find other examples of life, and I fully support that. I think it's entirely likely that we will. But in the meantime, we have extraordinary minds right here on our own planet that we just are beginning to understand. And it has struck me as such a huge tragedy that we are also in the process of causing the sixth extinction and causing so many animals, including elephants, to lose their place on our planet. And so what Phyllis is talking about is ways for us to address and to stop this terrible extinction that's currently underway. And yes, one of the important things that we must do is to find a way to think about the people who live in Africa and who live daily lives that intersect with these large animals, and how can they both live with these animals and protect them. It's a daunting challenge.
And Virginia, since you called in, just quickly, one of my favorite moments in the film was learning about Lawrence Anthony, the elephant whisperer, who basically lived with an elephant herd for 12 years. And when he passed away, the elephants were 12 miles from his house, and they walked to the house in mourning. And when they got to the house, they were agitated. And every year since then, on the anniversary of Lawrence Anthony's death, the elephant herd returned to his house.
Yes, I know it's quite remarkable, but you know that it is something that we see elephants do with each other, that they recognize the bones of other elephants that have passed. They don't necessarily recognize individuals, but they do discriminate. They don't stop and use their trunks to explore the skulls of giraffes or hippos or rhinoceroses, other large animals. They only do this with elephant bones. And if an elephant dies, their companions usually stand around. If there's an elephant calf, then the calf stands next to its mother's body. And you know, you can just see the emotion in these animals and their perception of having lost a close companion. So, in the case of Anthony's passing, it's not clear what exactly was going on, but some recognition that they had lost a member of their community.
Mm. Well, thank you so much for calling in, Virginia. Would you please stay on the line and we can get your contact info?
Sure.
Okay, thank you. Yeah. That is Virginia. It was Phyllis, I'm sorry, what was her last name?
Morrell.
Thank you.
She wrote a book called
Animal Wise. And she's in the film Wild Days.
Yeah, and she's currently doing something for Nat Geo with how to become an oceanographer for kids. There's a whole series they're doing. And she's really a smart woman, and she'd be an amazing guest, I'm sure.
And Andrea, we have about 15 minutes left and a couple more callers. But before we get to the callers, can you tell us, what else do we need to know about elephants? What else are we learning about elephants?
What a $10 million question!
I know there's so much, but I mean, what would you say that you want people to know who never interact with them?
I'll give you an example. The reason why I call my organization Elephant Action League. So, we actually focus on a variety of wildlife crime, rhino, pangolins, live apes, totoaba, vaquita, anything. So the people ask me, okay, you do all these, but why your organization is called Elephant Action League? You know, you're not doing just elephants. I said, no, we're doing a lot more. But I call Elephant Action League because I would like to see the qualities of elephants in the people around me, working with me. And that's why I answer all the time. So, of course, they ask, okay, what are these qualities? Why? So, for elephants, for example, are very powerful, but at the same time, humble. And that's a quality that I love to see in the people working with me. Elephants are very, very smart and intelligent beyond what you can think. But at the same time, they apply this intelligence to, you know, to important things. They are not showing off. They are not using this intelligence to take power over other species. Elephants in elephant societies, males are very important, but females are more important. And this is again another thing that I like to see in the people around me, in the people, especially people working with me in my team. So, you know, elephants embody so many good qualities. They're forgiving. We should really try to learn from them and see and try to seek this incredible qualities in the people around us.
And sadly, Phyllis, another thing we learn in your film is that the poachers want the oldest elephants with the tusks. And so these are the patriarchs, the grandmothers, the moms. And I mean, I love the way you put it, but it's just so sad. It really gives people a visual. All you have left are really the teenagers.
Yeah, I was very happy to ask Virginia Morell this question because I'd originally learned this from Richard Ruggiero. He used to be the chief of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife for very many years. He lived in Africa for very many years. And he said, it's like the Lord of the Flies. I mean, can you imagine what your community would be like if all the adults were gone? It'd be chaos. And that happens. You know, elephants suffer from PTSD, and they don't know where the water is to be found. They don't know if it's okay to mate. You know, the young bulls were culled in South Africa, for instance, and Lawrence Anthony's herd saw their whole family decimated and murdered in front of them, and they take the babies and they put them in another conservancy because South Africa's all fenced. So the bulls started fighting and doing crazy things and unusual things, like killing other species that they normally would just leave alone. And so what they did to solve it was they brought an old bull male in to tell them, hey, boys, here's how it goes. I mean, I grew up with four brothers. Thank God I had a strong father. Because these guys, we need to learn, you know, and elephants are no different than humans. We all need our elders, and we need to respect the elders.
Phyllis Stewart is director of the new documentary Wild Days, which is premiering at the Mill Valley Film Festival. You can see it if you're in the area October 8th, 10th, and 13th, and hopefully it'll be available more widely soon. We're also joined by Andrea Crosta, executive director and co-founder of the Elephant Action League. Let's go next to Alondra in Oakland. Hi, Alondra. Welcome to the show. Do we have Alondra? No. Okay. Sorry about that. You can give us a call back. We're almost out of time. This is going by so quickly. I want to talk about, now I talked about the film that was just the section of your film that was heartwarming. Now the section of the film that was incredibly difficult to watch. Phyllis, you interviewed Pete Swanepoel, a professional trophy hunter. And for the last 15 years, he has run a safari hunting company. And I'm so glad that you just asked him. You were not shy about asking him the bright questions. You know, why are animals trophies?
It took five interviews to get Pete to actually open up. He's a very lovely guy. I was terrified to meet a professional hunter. I'd never, you know, I was livid and scared, and I just became his buddy. And he's a decent guy. You know, his father put me up in Zambia when I landed there. They're not bad people. You know what I mean? It's what they do for a living.
Well, let's talk about the facts that he gave you, because he basically said that a 10-day hunt is $2,500. He said in many cases, underage animals will get shot. He said that he's hunted lions. He cries when he shoots an animal because it's not right to take an animal's life, which I thought was an interesting sentence. Now, he said 70% of the money goes to the government and very little goes to communities and things like conservation, education, or medical. But then when you interviewed Eric Schultz, the U.S. ambassador to Zambia, he said that most of the money goes to the hunters. So who's right? Are they both right?
It was an interesting paradox I put in the movie, and I felt like what Pete told me is that they only hunt 4 months out of the year because it's so remote and so difficult to get to Kafue, the area where his concession was. I can tell you it was. I went there. And most photographic safari tourists will not go there. So what happens in these parts, these super remote parts of Africa, is that there's unbridled bushmeat hunting and culling. And what happens with the hunters is that they will promise to build a health clinic, right? And the government of Zambia, for instance, owns the wildlife. So if a concessionaire builds a health clinic, they are legally obligated to put doctors into the super remote part of the bush. And otherwise, these people have no health. You know, women die in childbirth all the time there. So what they do is the money stays in the coffers of the big city. It very rarely goes way out into the bush. So it's a couple, you know, like Eric Schultz said, Ambassador Schultz said, you know, it's peanuts. It's a couple thousand dollars split between all these giant, you know, organizations. And the money doesn't filter to the people. So like Jeffrey Kent said in my movie, he created Photographic Safari, and he used to be a hunter. Mm. And he shot an elephant as his rite of passage as a Kenyan. And he said, you know, I felt like the money wasn't going to the people. And he's right. Jeffrey Kent, you know, created Abercrombie and Kenton. He knows that the people watching all these big safari trucks full of white tourists come in, he knows how much money they're spending to stay on the Masai Mara and to stay in these tented photographic safari outlets. But the people living on, who are basically kicked out of these areas to form parks, they don't get that money. They don't benefit from that money, so there is resentment.
Mm-hmm. What would you add to that, Andrea? Because there's such a debate around this issue about hunting. I mean, especially under the Trump administration.
Yes, it's a very it's more complicated than it looks like. It's of course a very polarized and heated debate. I would say that in some countries, trophy hunting is done properly. I mean, it's you can dislike it and you can be against it from an ethical point of view, like I do, for example, but you cannot say it is so detrimental for those species. In other countries, the situation is very different. And about 2 years ago, for example, our organization launched a campaign against a trophy hunting company in Tanzania owned by very powerful people in the Emirates, and because we receive videos of those people in those hunting concessions committing all kind of illegalities that you can do while trophy hunting. For example, they were shooting from a running car. You cannot do it. They were using automatic weapons. They were shooting animals during night.
They were shooting babies.
They were shooting animals while, you know, at the water holes. In one of these videos, you can even see a kid, maximum 11, 12 years old, who is shooting something. Mm. And then they were jumping from the car and they were playing with there's an awful video that they kill a zebra, a mother zebra, and then they start playing with the baby zebra, you know, passing each other. So these are clear illegalities, and this happens in many countries, in many hunting concessions. Unfortunately, the hunters and the owners of the hunting concessions are usually very, very, very powerful people, and you can do very little about it.
Just quickly, why do they kill zebra?
Oh, just a trophy, like
just
many
the
others.
Wow.
Yeah, just a trophy, and then they bring it back home and they put it in somewhere, and they like it, And you know, in those countries where hunting is legal, like Tanzania, for example, there is pretty much a price on any animal, and if you can afford it, you just do it. And but there are many ways to, you know, to bypass rules, especially if you're powerful.
And also, the Dallas Safari Club here is what my hunter was talking about. He didn't say it in the movie, but he talked about how the Safari Club International essentially tricks all its members and says, look, we'll give you a ring if you kill the big five. And it's really just all about your ego. And this boys club, like, hey, come to this banquet. You're going to get a ring because you killed a rhino and you killed a hippo and you killed an elephant and you killed a lion. So you're now a really important person. You're a great hunter. And it is absolutely not conservation. This money doesn't go to the locals, but they keep perpetuating the myth that, you know, trophy hunting is helping the locals. Yeah. They're going to eat the meat. Elephant meat is terrible. They don't want to eat the meat.
And it's very difficult to understand if those hunters in those countries coming, you know, from Europe, from America, know about. For example, I have another example we have been investigating for few years, a bunch of people in South Africa, they are basically, what they are doing is to, they lure certain animals, including elephants, but also lions and leopards, they lure them outside Kruger National Park into Mozambique, and then in Mozambique you have a party of hunters ready to kill them. And it's illegal, of course.
That's how Cecil the lion was killed. They lured him out of the park
with
meat.
But it's very difficult, you know, our investigation is also to aim and to understand if the hunters know about it, or they are just, you know, thinking that this leopard just simply materialized in Mozambique like that.
Wow.
Very difficult, because it's a very close-knit group to investigate, but certainly you have ample room for improvement, I would say.
Ample room. Well, we're unfortunately out of time, but thank you both for all the work you do. We didn't even get to talk about the sweet chimps, but we'll have to do a show about that. I'd also love to do a show about giraffes, because I mean, giraffes, the Center for Biological Diversity is putting pressure on the Trump administration. On average, the United States imports one giraffe hunting trophy a day. I mean, it's really astounding.
And by the way, Wild Daze is spelled D-A-Z-E, so if you're trying to find it on the web, it's Wild Daze the movie.
Yes.
It's like they're in a daze. Yeah, sorry for the confusion around
that.
No,
that's thank you for that. And you can find links at yourcallradio.org. Andrea Crosta is executive director and co-founder of the Elephant Action League, and Phyllis Stewart is director of the new documentary Wild Daze. It's premiering at the Mill Valley Film Festival October 8th, 10th, and the 13th. If you are in the Bay Area, if not, hopefully it'll be available soon. Phyllis,
or drive up. I'm driving up. Drive up.
Well, Phyllis and Andrea, thank you for your work. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye. Appreciate it.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Calls One Planet series.